this is what I would like to show you. In here, this is the photograph of the debris that was seen in General Ramey's office at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas. This is my father holding up what is very obviously parts of a radar target with balloon debris. In here, you see basswood fragments. You have actually parts of the balloon envelope in of itself, and you have what looks like paperback metal foil. And to emphasize this is not what was seen on the floor of our kitchen that evening or that late early morning hours in 1947. This is totally different.
He had been the commander here in 1947, and I was at a table with the general and several other locals when they were interrogating him about the 1947 incident, and he declined to answer any of the questions, except he did comment that it was the damnedest thing he'd ever seen.
He never would discuss it, but several months later, one night, I badgered him again, as I like to do, and he said, well, and he paused. He said, I'll tell you this, and I'm paraphrasing him because I don't remember exactly how he said it, but in essence, he said, what I saw, I've never seen before.
It took me a while to realize that there's something strange about it, but the more I saw the fragments, the more I realized that it wasn't anything that I was acquainted with. I proved I tried to burn it, but it wouldn't burn. I tried to break it, it would not break. If it was something of ours, I'm sure there would be no reason to keep it under cover that long. It's an aerial spacecraft. There's another reason why it would not ever be known by anybody here until they found out more about it. I sense that there was a cover-up someplace about this whole matter.
My mother told me, you are not to discuss this, and this is a point of which this is more than top secret, as he said. It's beyond that. It's within my priority as deputy to George Kennedy, and he in turn responsible to the president. This is the highest priority you can exist, and you will say nothing. And that's the end of it. And Jesus, that's in the commander-in-chief, and you forgot about it.
General DuBose said that specifically to us, that the balloon explanation that the Air Force offered was a cover story. Do you get the reporters off General Rainey's back? So we have a wide body of testimony that it was a cover-up. We have military witnesses saying they were sworn to secrecy. We have radio employees telling us that they were told if they broadcast their interview with Mac Brazel, they better look for a new job because they'd be out of the radio business the next day. We can show that beyond a shadow of a doubt. There's no question it was a cover-up.
He had this club or stick or whatever it was, and he was beating it on his hand, and he would hit it. Every time he would say something, he'd hit his hand. And he said, I want you to know you were never there. Now, I didn't understand what he meant, so I said, yes, I was. And he said, no, you weren't. I said, yes, I was. And he said, can't you get this through your head? You never saw anything. You were not there. You don't know anything. And he said, you know, this is a big desert out here. We can just take you out in the middle of this desert and no one will ever find your bodies. He said, you'll be nothing but bones and nobody will ever know what happened to you.
Welcome to the conclusion of the Roswell interviews, and thank you all for being here. But before we dive in, I'd like to say a special thank you to Jessica, Ruby, and Dario. We appreciate your support and generosity. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit us at patreon.com/paranormalmysteries or at buymeacoffee.com/paranormal, where you can make a one-time donation. And remember that sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to the podcast helps to support us as well, and we thank you. Tonight, I'd like to play the last four interviews in our series regarding the Roswell UFO incident. And without further ado, let's get into it.
Jess, how about just saying your whole name so that we can make sure we get everything right?
Jesse Antoine Marcel.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Antoine.
Okay.
And you are a physician?
Correct.
And what field of medicine do you practice?
Well, I specialize in ear, nose, and throat conditions, you know, tonsillitis, ear infections, you name it. Anything above the clavicle, I have to do with.
And you also are in the National Guard?
Correct.
How long have you been serving the National Guard?
Since 1978 or 79.
Jess, I wonder if I can take you back to the night that your father came home. You have an idea about what time of the night that was and what you were doing at the time?
Well, I was asleep, for one thing. I want to say it was very early hours. It was either very late in the evening or very early in the morning when he came back here. And I had awakened both myself and my mother.
And why did he wake you both up?
He had something he wanted to show us. This apparently was some debris or something he brought in from the field at that time. And I understand he was on his way to the air base to deliver this, but he felt that this was unusual enough that he wanted us to see it first before he delivered it to his proper destination.
And what happened? What happened after he woke you up?
Well, he was, as I recall, very excited, and again, he said, "I want to show you something." And so I got my house coat on, did my mother, and he had gone out to the car and brought back in some metallic debris. I believe it was in a box. I know, I don't recall whether I walked outside with him or not, but he made it seem like the 1942 Buick we had was loaded with the stuff. In the back seat and in the trunk area. At any rate, he brought the material in and spread it on the kitchen floor, and in an effort to try to piece it together like a jigsaw puzzle to get some idea of the form of this, but unfortunately there was too much of it, too finely divided to do that.
How old were you at the time?
11.
And when he spread all this material out on the floor, what was your impression about what this material was like? How would you describe it?
Well, initially, just looking at it, I said, well, what's this all about? You know, sleepy. But then when you get down and looking at it, it was the unusual character of the debris. And I want to say that he said something like, this is from a flying saucer, but I'm not sure that he said that. But the meaning was clear that this is something very special. He wanted us to look at.
And what's your recollection about what the material looks like, felt like?
Well, I could divide it into three major categories. I'm thinking back on it quite a few times. There was a lot of rather thick foil-like material, not a shiny aluminum, but burnished or a slate gray type of aluminum metal. There was a black plastic type debris like Bakelite, which was shattered. It was very brittle material. And then there were fragments of what appeared to be I-beams, relatively small, but the typical I-beam type configuration.
Let's talk a little bit about each category for in a little bit of detail, if you will. Let's talk about first the foil-like substance. What was the size of this material?
Well, I don't recall seeing any piece that was greater than 4 to 6 inches in circumference or in diameter. I don't recall whether I tried to test it for being able to tear it or bend it or anything like that. It was very light, and again, a dull metallic gray color. And there was a lot of that.
How thick would you describe this material?
Well, it was about... was thicker than the usual kitchen foil. I guess there's a newer foil out now for heavy duty use that is used in storing food, and that's approximately what it was like.
In terms of thickness?
In terms of thickness.
Any other similarities to everyday household items that people...
Well, it's metallic, you know, that's about all I can say. Not shiny.
And the pieces of the foil-like substance, what shape were they?
Well, it was shredded, at least torn.
So irregular in shape?
Irregular, right.
And there was a lot of this material?
Well, enough to cover the floor with.
Was this...
And more, because there was a lot more left in the car.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. He didn't bring in all of it?
Oh, no. That was only one portion of the car.
Okay. The weight of this material you described as light, would you say that it was unusually light, lighter than you would expect, or heavier, or anything at all unusual about its weight?
Well, feathers. Very, very light.
Very light.
Okay. In other words, you could take a piece and it wouldn't just fall to the floor, but it kind of drift down fairly slow like a feather.
No, that's very interesting.
And
did you actually see that?
No, I did not, but this is what, I would have thought it would be like, if I would have done that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it was
light as a feather. Interesting. The what you described as an almost plastic or bakelite-like material. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, it was black, brown in color. Again, irregular pieces. About a 16th of an inch, maybe a little bit greater in thickness. And brittle. At least I suspect it was brittle because it shattered like glass.
I'm going to make sure I understand. You didn't actually see it shatter,
no.
But it appeared to have been shattered.
Yeah, I didn't try to bend or test any of these things I saw. I just picked them up gently and handled them. Okay.
Anything else unusual about the weight of this material? Plastic?
It was very light also. It's kind of hard to... I don't recall it as comparing it with the other at this point.
Anything else worthy of comment about this material that you recall?
Basically just the description, the color, shatter type, bakelite material. Then.
Now how about what you described as I-beams? What were those like?
Well, they were, again, looked like the same type of material that the foil-like material is made of. Metallic, dull gray aluminum, except very light again. I did not try to bend it or stress it in any way, although the piece I remember looking at was about 12 to 18 inches in length. Both ends, I think, were shattered or broken off. Wasn't as clean cut. And the material thickness appeared to be about a 16th of an inch.
And what color was it?
Again, it was a dull gray, like a flat aluminum finish, I guess would be a good way to describe that.
Metallic?
Metallic, definitely metallic.
Okay. Anything else unusual about this particular piece of material?
Well, the most unusual part of this whole thing was what was on the I-beam, on the inner surface of the I-beam. Because as you look at it head on, there appeared to be a type of writing on the mainframe itself. This writing was definitely a purplish violet hue. It did have an embossed appearance because you could rub your finger along it and you could tell it had texture. I don't recall seeing any lines or letters of any kind, but it was more like geometric shapes or it's hard to describe it. It was a curved geometric shapes. There might have been some triangles and circles, but it was solid.
Is it possible you might have mistaken it for Russian, Japanese, any other language?
No way.
Anything like hieroglyphics?
Well, in my first impression was, this is Egyptian hieroglyphics, but I knew enough at that time to know that it wasn't, because hieroglyphics usually have some animal symbols in it also, but there was none.
And the lettering, or we can call it lettering, of these symbols?
Individual symbols. Uh-huh. They were not connected.
Okay. Were they in color?
Yeah, yes.
But they were on a surface that was what?
Well, the surface was the same color as the rest of the I-beam, dull metallic gray.
So it was just the symbols that were in a kind of purple pink.
That's right. That is the color that caught your eye. Hearing all this mass of metallic gray pieces, there here's this flash of color.
What do you recall your father saying that night about how he came into possession of this material?
I don't recall a whole lot of the mechanics or the logistics involved. I do know he'd been gone for quite a while. I'm not sure exactly how long he'd been gone even, but if I remember saying something about this came from a crash site or from some fellow's ranch here northwest of Roswell.
And you said at the outset that he appeared to be excited.
Yeah, that's the reason he got us up out of bed.
Why was he excited about this?
Because he felt this was something very unusual. He felt it was probably something we'd never seen before, would never see again. And again, I want to say that he said the words flying saucer, but I cannot be sure about that. I'm almost positive he did, but I can't recall verbatim what he said.
When you said that your father had been gone for some time, do you mean hours or days or something?
Well, again, you know, my memory's kind of hazy about how long he was gone. I know he was maybe more than 12 hours, maybe a day or so.
And how long was he at your home that night with the material on the floor?
The total time there was about 15 or 20 minutes.
And what happened after that?
Loaded up back in the car and took off.
Do you know where he went?
Well, he was going back to the base. That was my understanding.
When did you next see him, do you recall?
I think it was the next day, although I'm not absolutely sure about that either.
And did you have any conversation with him about what had transpired since you had seen him last?
Well, you know, he would kind of recall those conversations. I don't know that we had talked about it very much afterwards. The initial excitement had worn off, and then the whole deal kind of was put to rest. There's still a feeling like there's something very unusual about this. It was not, you know, something commonplace, like they would like to say, a weather balloon or a radar target.
Your father didn't think it was a weather balloon or a radar target?
Never did.
Do you think it was?
Well, even at that young age, I had kind of an interest in electronics and weather and things like that, and I'd seen weather balloons. And I've seen pictures of radar targets. That was not one of them.
Was it like anything you'd ever seen before?
Not really. One thing that sets it apart, of course, was those I-beams with the symbols.
Did your father ever speculate about what it was, where it came from?
We would talk about it periodically over the next several years, perhaps. And we'd always thought that it was something very unusual. It would, you know, I think initially they might have thought it was even a Russian weapon or something had come to earth. That was for the reason for the cover up or the burying the story. But later it was determined it was not a Russian thing. And, so that left one other possibility, that it was something from out of our atmosphere.
Was your father in the habit of discussing his work when he was in intelligence?
No, he was not.
Not in the habit of discussing his work. So I guess it wouldn't be real unusual for him to be rather quiet about it.
Tight-lipped about it, yes. He was not given to, you know, verbal diarrhea about things like that.
But he obviously did eventually talk.
As time went on, you know, the seed had been planted in the back of our minds that there's something very unusual about this. And from time to time, you'd read about some UFO sighting in the paper, and it would trigger maybe a little conversation about what this was.
Knowing your father as you did, what do you think motivated him to go public with this account as he did?
Well, this didn't happen for years. And he was a radio amateur, loved ham radio. And I don't know the exact scenario, but I can picture that maybe they were talking on ham radios. He was talking on ham radio with somebody. And maybe the discussion came up about a recent UFO sighting. And he would say, oh, by the way, I was involved with one. And I could picture that as being the mechanism that this thing came out. I don't know that to be sure, but that's, I think, most likely way.
And when journalists and people came to ask him to be interviewed for this, do you think he had any reluctance? Do you know if he had any reluctance about speaking more publicly to a wider audience about this?
Well, this is many years later, and he'd lost track or touch with the Air Force community. And I think at that time the uniqueness had worn off a bit where he felt less constrained to keep quiet.
Kevin, I don't have any more questions. Anything that we failed to cover that's important?
When your dad came home, did he ever suggest you weren't supposed to talk about it? Was there any kind of discussion about what was said at the base and let's not talk about this anymore in those first few days?
I don't recall that exactly, but I think the implication was there that it's over with, don't say anything more about it, at least don't even bring it up.
Did, after he came out with the story in 78, was there ever any contact with anyone in the Pentagon or anybody from the military suggesting that maybe he had spoken out of turn?
No. Going back to the first statement, too, I never discussed this with any of my friends either. I had a lot of friends and acquaintances in Roswell, and I can definitely say I never even told them about what was going on.
Later on, you had suggested that it was in high school before you'd really ever discussed it again with your dad. Did you ever discuss it with any of your friends in high school when the stories would come out in the newspapers or suggest to anybody, well, you know, these things are real?
I don't recall ever saying anything about it.
When you'd see these stories in the newspapers, kind of what was your reaction to it? Did you kind of, I know something more about it? Or?
Well, my initial reaction is maybe most of these are hoaxes and maybe a misidentification of things, but I do know one that was not. Identification.
Was it the feeling of you, your father, your mother, that it was extraterrestrial in origin?
Yes. We felt it was all a very unique experience that we just happened to be at the right place at the right time to have seen this.
But was your feeling that it was extraterrestrial?
Yes. Actually, my own personal thoughts was, after we started sending satellites around, the Russians in 1957 with the Sputnik, I felt that maybe this was a probe that happened to land on our planet from someplace else.
From another planet.
From another origin.
When you had the debris in the kitchen, was there any odor associated with any of the debris at all that you can recall?
No.
Did the material feel cold to the touch at all?
Well, it was metallic, it's a hot night, so it didn't. I'm sure it's the ambient air temperature, whatever that was at that time.
Is there any possibility that your dad might have slipped a piece out of the box to keep for his souvenir?
No possibility.
He'd never think of doing something like that?
Not at all.
His background was intelligence. Was that his job all through his military career? Was he always in intelligence?
Well, that and photo analysis. Interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Now, did there have been stories that he flew as a gunner?
Well, he did man the guns, I know that. I think what happened, he was a navigator, or he went aloft many times to view the bombing runs personally, despite the fact they had photographs, but he'd get more information by being there on the site. And I do know one time that they were shot pretty badly, and he had to take over for the guns. He must have known how to man the 50 calibers for some reason. I know he did that. He described sitting on an empty box of ammo and having some slugs go between his legs through the box from a Japanese was firing at him.
and was quite excited about that, I can imagine.
And another time they were shot down. They had two of the engines. Four engines shot out. The plane in a B-29 doesn't fly very well on two, and when the third one gave up, they're going down like a rock.
Did he have to bail out, or did they?
They bailed out. Yes.
Bailed out. So his military career, he was basically an intelligence mostly for his
right.
For his military career.
And he would get stick time as a pilot too, as much as he could. the non-rated aviator type.
We know how that works.
Yeah.
There are many stories about his military career. He did not stay for the full 20.
No, he did not.
He got out as a lieutenant colonel.
Major. He was given a reserve commission as a lieutenant colonel, but he was on active duty as a major.
So he never served as a lieutenant colonel?
He never served as a lieutenant colonel. I know a lot of the reserve papers he got to was addressed to Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Marcel, but he never had the privilege. Lieutenant Colonel.
So he got out, he had no military pension?
No.
He got out of the service, went back to home in Louisiana. Was a TV radio repairman or?
Right.
Owned a?
Yeah, radio, television, and sales service.
And that's what he did until he retired? And the first time you remember him really talking about this, you were in high school, said something while you were in high school?
Well, about that time frame, you know, because at that era, you know, flying saucers were in the rage, you know, you'd read about these reports in the papers, and the sensational magazines and things like that, which tend to degrade the story.
as if we need that, that sort of thing. But he was, for the most part, pretty close-lipped about this, even after he was out of the military.
Right. Yeah. It was not really a daily topic.
And there was no military pension for him to protect, or no threat of...
No, the only thing he had from the military was he fell off the roof when he was repairing his ham radio antenna in Roswell, and he had a fracture of the arm and elbow, and I think he had $14 a month, you know, for disability, you know, which is a very minor disability. But that was the only thing he got.
So that there was no threat they could hold over him, that if you talked about this, we're going to take away your pension or anything
like that.
Do you remember how much time he spent on active duty, how many years he got in?
Well, I know he went in 1942. And stayed till 1949 or 1950.
So 7 or 8 years is all. And there was the story that's been published that he wrote the speech for Truman when the atomic bomb was exploded by the Soviets. Any truth to that, or he provided the intelligence information for the president?
I have a vague recollection of something of that nature, but I don't know that he wrote the speech, but I do know that he was in on preparing something, gathering information.
It's part of his intelligence function.
Right, yeah, but that was not really a subject of conversation. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever notice your dad, or did your dad ever break security other than this one time when he brought the material home? Although he really wasn't breaking security since it wasn't classified yet. Did your dad ever break security at all that you can recall?
One other time.
And that would be when?
I don't know whether one of them. I guess it's... I hate to bring that up, though. I don't know whether...
Okay. But as far as you know, your dad really never broke security.
Right.
He never really talked to the neighbors. He never talked to friends about what he was learning with his job.
No, it was all pretty fortunate.
Okay. Jess, thank you very much. I'm just going to ask you some questions just to get you started.
No.
Okay. Vern, tell me about your relationship with Barney Barnett. How did you know Barney?
I first met Mr. Barnett. I was with the 333rd Bomb Group in Dalhart, Texas. At that time, Mr. Barnett was living in Mosquera, New Mexico. I met him in late 1943. I was on a bomb drive for the squadron commander out of Dalhart, Texas.
So you both were in the service together?
No, we were not in the service together. He was a civilian working with as a civil engineer with the state of New Mexico.
And what kind of relationship did the two of you have?
Well, Barney didn't have any children. He'd raised a niece. He sort of took me under his thumb. And during the visits, he treated me just about like a son. Mm-hmm.
So pretty close relationship.
Real close relationship.
I understand around 1950 he told you a story about something that had happened sometime previous. Can you relate that story to us?
Yes. Mr. Burnett told me that when he was coming back from one of his field trips, he'd run onto a flying saucer that had burst open, and there were four beings on the ground, and that he was surveying the site, and about that time was an archaeological group from the University of Pennsylvania come on the site. There were about four or five people with this group. As they were just starting to look things over fairly closely, the military moved in and gave them a briefing to not say anything about it and to keep quiet, and that it was in the national interest that they get out of there.
What was his feeling about what it was that he had experienced?
He had no qualms about what it was. He said the vehicle from outer space without any question. The beings on there were not exactly like human beings. Similar, but not exactly.
How did he describe them?
He described them being about 3.5 to 4 feet tall, very slim in stature, and their heads were hairless, with no eyebrows, no eyelashes, no hair, and sort of a pear-shaped head, with the top of the head being smaller, or larger, I mean. Mm-hmm.
Any other characteristics about their appearance?
Only one thing that he mentioned is the hands were not covered. They had four fingers.
How were they dressed?
They were dressed in some type of a tight-fitting suit. It looked like a metallic, but not metal and not nylon. And it fit to the body very closely, tight. But they were not wearing any headpiece at all. And I don't recall that he said anything about what they had on their feet.
Were all of these beings dead when he found them?
They were all dead in only a short distance from the craft. The craft burst open, and they didn't. He said that they hadn't seen anybody inside, but they really hadn't had a chance to look. These were all outside the craft and quite close to the craft, within not too many feet from the object.
How did he describe the craft?
Typical flying saucer.
Disc-shaped?
Disc-shaped, and a pretty good size, not small. It was a craft that probably could have carried quite a few beings. It wasn't one of the little small discs at the three-quarter in Sydney's place. It was probably 100 feet. Big.
Really? How did he describe the impact site, if at all?
He said it had come to rest at a sort of on a, not a high bank, but a sort of a ridge or a bank, and had hit against the bank, had split there. But otherwise, it was intact.
Did he describe any other debris or wreckage besides the...
There was no, according to him, there was no wreckage or debris around his craft.
But did he give any description about the archaeology team?
Nothing except it was four or five people. And they were obviously there for a dig, and they had just come upon this just about nearly simultaneously. He just arrived there, and here they came.
Any names of any of these individuals?
He didn't have any names, because the short period that they were there, and by the time the army rounded them up, and told him to get out of there after he'd briefed him what and not to say and so on, he got his pickup and headed back for his office.
Did he ever tell this story to anybody else?
He went back to his office, and his boss, he started to tell him, and the boss told him, "Barney, don't tell me anything about it. I don't want to hear about it. Just forget it." And he says, "When I was told that," he said, having been told not to say anything, he said, "And I'm not going to have people think I'm crazy." I never told anybody else until the time he told me about it.
Did he ever experience any form of harassment from the government?
They were harassing him on income taxes. And I know that one time I visited him down there in 1950, and he was really nervous. This was either the second or third time they had audited him. And I can't understand why they would audit him, because he didn't do any outside business. They had all of his income from his job.
What kind of man was Barney Barnett?
Barney Barnett was a real private individual. He didn't smoke, he didn't drink. His family and himself were very private. They associated with people, but not too much on a social basis. But he was very reliable, professional man, lived a lot in the outdoors, and knew the outdoors, collected arrowheads. And he and I went on arrowhead hunts, had gone on pottery digs ourselves. He showed me how to rattlesnakes operate and how they struck and so on. So we had a lot of time together because way out there in New Mexico when you're driving around, there's miles and miles and miles, there's nothing. So we had a lot of time to talk. But in all the time I knew Barney, he never told me a story. I was never told any story of any kind about anything. So I believed anything that he would say was reliable. I could have had a lot more information, but I didn't pump him for information. At that time, I was raising a family and busy in the military and had 15 things to do. And I could have got a lot more information from him, I'm sure. But it was one of those things that you think back. We hadn't had anybody in outer space. We hadn't had anybody in the moon. If we had progressed with this sort of thing, I might have been a little bit more interested in details.
When he related this account, what did you think about the story?
I had no doubts about it. Knowing his reliability, I had no doubts, but it was real. And of course, he said that he was sworn to secrecy. I was still in the Air Force, so I didn't go around blabbing this to everybody. Matter of fact, I had no reason to really bring it up to anybody. The first time it was brought up is when the doctor, Friedenberg, was in Bemidji. He gave a lecture on UFOs, had gone. And I listened to this. I thought, you know, I wonder if I should relate this to him. They're doing a study and this stuff. It might be important to his studies. So as a matter of fact, I thought about it. And then I left the auditorium. And it was cold out. It was late fall, I think. I walked about a half a block from there without saying anything. And I thought, well, maybe it's a good policy to go back and tell him. You know, I didn't feel comfortable not doing it. So then I walked back and talked to him, and a few days later, this Mr. Moore was near, and he came over to my house and interviewed me about the details that I had.
Have you experienced any repercussions from having shared this?
None. I haven't had anybody harass me. Everybody that watched Unsolved Mysteries, I've had nothing but good comments. Most people believe these actually exist. I don't really believe that I've had one bad comment. However, they intentionally didn't give your address, but I had calls from every province in Canada except the eastern ones, from Florida, Texas. And the amount of people that seen this, I was amazed.
So you don't have any regrets about having divulged this?
I have no regrets about it. As a matter of fact, I could tell the same story 1,000 times without changing it because I know it to be actual facts. I'm not about to alter anything. And I wouldn't accept one penny or one dime to make any statement because that would ruin the validity of what Mr. Barnett, and in respect to him, I wouldn't do it.
As a former military man, what do you think our government should do now that this story is out?
I can't see any reason why whatever information I have is not released. I think any information or documents should be released. Because most of the public believes they exist anyhow. And I think the population now is better prepared to accept this sort of thing than they would have been in 1947, right after World War II. There were probably reasons why they didn't want it released. I can't see any reason for not releasing.
Okay. Anything that we've not covered that you want to talk about?
Well, the only time that I had any occasion to possibly see a flying saucer, in 1940, the 7th Bomb Group, 11th Bomb Squadron. We'd moved off the coast because of the problems with an imminent war. So we'd moved into Salt Lake City, and we're working out of the municipal airport out there. And just about, it was between 12 and 1 o'clock, there was a disc-like object that come over Salt Lake City. It come from the east over the Wasatch Mountains. In the daytime, it looked like the moon does if you see it in the daytime. And there was two pilots that I knew out there, I can't recall their names, and myself out there. And we run for a B-17. And we immediately started, didn't run the proper checks and other routes. taxi ran out to the runway and took off, and we chased us. I mean, there was no hope. It was just distances. And it could not possibly have been another airplane or balloon, because the B-17 was about as fast a thing as there was on the market at that time. It came over from the east, went right directly over the airfield, and then it went west, and when we took off, then it just about went at a real steep angle going to the northwest, went up. It kept getting smaller and smaller until it was just like a little dot up there. Nothing that I know of could possibly climb that fast.
And this was what year?
1940. And because it went overseas in 1941. I was in Hawaii on 1st December 1941. I was quite familiar with airplanes. I'd always had an interest in aviation, and that's why I went into the Air Corps. So I have an idea what they would do and could recognize the difference between something like that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all your time.
Well, I hope it works out good, but that's basically what they were pretty accurate in, you know, trying to reconstruct. Mm-hmm. And they did film about 20, 30, 40 minutes of me. Mm-hmm. But they only used portion, and they reconstructed some of the rest of it. Mm-hmm.
Did you, were you satisfied then with the dramatization part of it?
Pretty much, but there was some details that would have changed. Uh-huh. And of course it was impossible for them to know every detail. If I had been on their site, I could have told them some changes they could have made.
Yeah. Like Barney wearing a pith helmet?
Yeah, wearing the pith helmet. and another thing, he had glasses.
Uh-huh.
Because of that, when he opened his snake's mouth and the venom came up over his glasses, that's how I vividly remember. I can picture in my mind the venom still streaming down his face and on his glasses. And he'd hit the glasses mostly.
Uh-huh.
And it was just kind of a white foam. And you know, they,
good thing he wore glasses, I guess, huh?
But that's the type of individual he was, an outdoorsman. Uh-huh. He knew the Southwest, he knew the outdoors, and he was the type of individual that didn't exaggerate on anything. We did a lot of things outdoors. And I know that New Mexico, because I know what a vast, uninhabited area that place is.
Yeah.
That's why the group in New Mexico is kind of laughing about some of the things I was talking about.
Because they know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they know exactly. But I'd been through a good portion of the state and I'd lived there.
Uh-huh.
I lived in Clayton, New Mexico one time.
Uh-huh. Where are you living at?
Bemidji.
Uh-huh. Still in Bemidji.
Still in Bemidji.
Uh-huh.
And I put in 21 years in the United States Air Force and retired from them. I put in 30 years with the VA, just about 30 years.
So?
I like working. And I'm interested in things. When I visit foreign countries, other places, I see everything. Industries, what the people are doing, how they make a living. You know, I'm not one contented just to sit back and go and lay in the sun somewhere or go to the beach, whatever.
Yeah.
I just like to get in the mainstream of things. I'm interested in what's going on in the world and out of this world, too.
Yeah, obviously. Mr. Porter, what were you doing in Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947?
I was a flight crew member.
At the Army Air Base?
Right.
And what was your rank?
As Master Sergeant.
And what would normally be your duties as a flight crew member?
I was a flight engineer.
Engineer.
Okay.
And what sort of normal activities would you engage in?
Well, I took care of the engines in flight, well, and weight and balance and fuel management.
And did you log in a lot of hours in doing this?
Right.
What craft did you usually fly, sir?
It's a B-29.
Explosive wing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then.
All right. I understand that something rather unusual happened in July of 1947 at the base, and you were involved in a flight. What happened that day that you recall?
Well, we flew these pieces. They told us it was a parts of the flying saucer, and we flew from Roswell to Fort Worth. And we started out, they told us we'd be going to Wright-Patterson in Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And we got to Fort Worth, and they transferred them to a B-25 and took them on to Wright-Patterson.
And what did you do then?
Then we returned to Roswell.
Okay. Who do you recall was on board that B-29 when you left Roswell?
Colonel Jennings was on board, and Colonel Barrowclaw, Major Wunderlich, and Major Marcel was the ones up front.
Okay. And who was it who told you that these were pieces of a flying saucer?
I don't remember just who it was, but it must have been Captain Henderson.
Okay. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, it was first I'd heard of a bunch of flying saucers.
So it didn't really mean a whole lot,
I
guess. What was it that was actually loaded on board that you saw?
Well, we had it's just packages and wrapping paper. Uh-huh. And one of them was triangle-shaped, about 2.5 feet across the bottom. And the rest were in smaller packages, about shoebox size.
The triangle shape, is that an unusual kind of packaging?
It seemed to be.
And this was brown paper on the outside?
Right, with tape.
Uh-huh. And did you actually load this stuff?
Yes, right.
What was your feeling when you...
Well, just like I picked up an empty package.
Is that right?
Right.
Very light.
Right.
From feeling the package, did you have a sense of what it was that was underneath the brown paper wrapper?
Not really.
Just brown just paper and tape, mm-hmm. But very light.
Right.
And approximately how much of this stuff did you bring onto the B-29?
Well, it's the one triangle-shaped package and about three shoebox size packages.
Oh, so it wasn't...
Not very much.
Okay. I don't know, if we were to... Can you give me an idea about what the volume of all of this would be?
Well, it's...
Could you put it in, a back seat of a car or
yes.
a trunk of a car?
Yes, it's just small packages.
And you took a B-29? Was it necessary to take a B-29?
Well, that was the transportation, I guess.
That's all you had?
Right.
Okay. And what did the fellows talk about on the way to
there wasn't much talk. They didn't talk back and forth very much. Nothing about it.
Yeah. Much. Would that be unusual? Was there normally a lot of conversation between the officers?
This wasn't
crew?
A regular crew, so it,
How is that? Why do you say it wasn't regular?
Oh, we had officers from other squadrons in the plane. And the Colonel Jennings was the deputy base commander. And Major Marcel was the intelligence officer.
Would it be unusual for them to be on such a flight?
Yes. Right.
And you arrived at Fort Worth at Carswell?
Right.
And what happened then?
Well, we parked on the front flight line, and Colonel Jennings told us to finish. We had some spark plugs to change, and he said as soon as we got our maintenance done and a guard was posted, we could go eat lunch and come back then.
Was there anything unusual about your arrival at Fort Worth?
No.
So you did your maintenance, and then you went out
right.
to lunch? And what happened after you got back?
We came back, and they moved the aircraft to the back flight line.
Mm-hmm.
And told us that they'd transferred the material to a B-25 to go into Wright-Patterson, and that it was a weather balloon, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I just thought this was what it was.
You accepted what you were
right.
told. And then you flew back to Roswell?
Right.
Was there any conversation on the way back about this?
No.
How about after this episode? Was there any more?
No, nothing.
Was it something that just wasn't talked about, or did you feel that it shouldn't be talked about?
Well, we just thought it was a weather balloon,
okay.
And that was it.
That was it. Okay. When did you first share, or when were you asked about your involvement in this?
In 1979. Stan Friedman called me in 1979.
Uh-huh. And what did you learn anything more about this than you had known before?
Not a whole lot, no.
Does it surprise you to know that Jesse Marcel at least said that it was not a weather balloon?
Well, not really. I never thought much about that.
Uh-huh. after all these years, what do you think it was?
It wasn't a weather balloon.
You're pretty sure of that?
Right. Okay.
That's because of what people said?
Yes, right.
Yeah. You're out of the service.
Yes.
For a while now, I guess.
27 years, I guess.
Uh-huh. Are you getting a pension?
Yes.
Have you gotten any kind of harassment or anything?
None at all.
From having talked about this?
No.
Do you have any regrets about having talked about it?
No.
What do you think the government should do now about all this?
Well, I think they should let the people know what's what on it.
You'd like to know, I guess.
Yes.
So would we. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to say, Mr. Porter?
No.
As long as we got it all straight. Uh-huh. Okay. Uh-huh. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A little bit about yourself. Where are you living now, and what's been your profession over the past few years?
Well, at present, I and my wife reside in Southern California in a small community called Spring Valley. It's in the neighborhood of San Diego. I think for our purposes, that's close enough.
Uh-huh.
And I practice as a dentist in that region. From about 1952, after my release from active duty after following the Korean police action, I think that's correctly noted.
Right.
And I met Pappy Henderson in the early mid-60s, to the best of my recollection. It had been maybe 1962 or 63.
How did you happen to meet him or know him?
I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. And we were, of course, one of my other vocations other than dentistry has been practice of studying metallurgy. I think that's probably what got Pappy and I together. Mm-hmm. And as the years went along, we went into other ventures. I wound up actually joining one of his because it really proved to be interesting, and I described that fully at our meeting today. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know what else to say. We gained a great deal of respect for each other, and I trusted his judgment as he did mine, I guess. Just was a very nice relationship that we developed.
And when did he tell you about something that occurred that was very unusual in 1947?
Well, it was as near as I am able to tell. Would have been, and I think it might have been perhaps the 30th anniversary of that event, because it was right about that time in the summer of 1978.
Okay. And what was it that he related to you as to what had occurred?
Well, and he, of course, we will understand, we were in a public place where we met frequently. And but we did speak in a great deal of privacy, let's say. And he told me about the Roswell incident. When that incident occurred, I happened to have been in a period of inactive duty in my naval service, and I was living in northern Minnesota. And I guess the wire service never reached me. I was actually unaware of the Roswell incident. It was casually mentioned in our newspapers perhaps as late as a month later. Who knows? But northern Minnesotans weren't too worried about what happened in Mexico.
So what did Pappy Henderson tell you happened?
But he said that he had an unusual job to perform while he's in his Air Force service, and that he transported wreckage and bodies of the alien people to Ohio.
Uh-huh.
It was that simple. And Jack was a man of few words, really. And in our habit, the way we dealt and talked with each other, we really didn't waste much time. We said it, and that's that. There's nothing more to it.
Did he describe any of the wreckage to you?
Not really at that time. It was just a smashed pile of, I guess, space wreckage, spacecraft garbage, and the I guess some of the passengers thereon suffered their death, of course. And I really was more or less privileged to just be listening, so I refrained from asking a lot of questions. But he did say that these people were small, and that there were quite a number of them. He never described the actual number to me, but since I've, of course, been filled in somewhat, I'm still not sure that there were what they even claim now. There may have been a lot more.
Did he describe their appearance any further than saying they were small?
Not to me. I think he found the kind of distasteful. I was pretty well tuned into Jack's feelings, you know. If something was bothering him, I'd be sort of aware of it very soon.
Do you know what kind of craft he flew to Wright-Patterson?
Well, as a Navy man, I wasn't too familiar with what the Army Air Corps, later Air Force, had. You know, my experience with airplanes ended with the Taylor craft and Pipers and Aranca sedans and things like that. Pre-World War II, things that I flew. The rest of it was lost. But it was one of the Bs, B-29 perhaps.
Did he say what his takeoff point was?
Well, I assumed it was Roswell. He did not say to me where it was from.
But that he did say that he was going to Wright-Patterson.
Yep, that's where he did say, and he said that the remains were there. And he said very likely in a frozen state. Which would lead me to believe that that being the case, that autopsy work was being planned. And I would have undoubtedly been performed.
Did he relate any information following this flight that would shed some light on what the wreckage or the bodies were all about?
No, it was perhaps a year later. We were meeting again under about the same circumstances. We decided to have a game of pool, and when we had a little break in our game, he produced this piece of metal for me to look at. He said, what do I think of it? He said, well, it's different. And when I felt it, and it did feel it, and I studied it some, I was able to determine that its the metal structure was different than alloys like we have in our aircraft, for instance. And of course, he did preface his question by stating this was from this craft. And apparently, I think it was a case of appropriation that he acquired this, you know, for future study, perhaps. At any rate, I gave it a good thorough looking at and decided that it was an alloy that we are not used to, or we have not, we don't think we do, but there is a possibility we may be able to come up with something like it.
What do you,
it's
you
a very big roundabout statement.
I understand. How about describing it for me? What did it look like, feel like?
Well, it was a lustrous, a gray lustrous metal that resembled aluminum. It was lighter in weight and much stiffer. If you're familiar with aluminum alloys like ST-37, is a very stiff, tough aluminum. Well, this was harder and stiffer than that.
Could you bend it?
No. Not, and I didn't want to try. The edges were pretty sharp. And Jack didn't want to let it out of his personal ownership, you know. So I couldn't take it into my lab and do some testing on it, which I really would like to. Number one, I'd like to have found out what it would take to machine it. In other words, in machinist language, to mill it. That decision came out as a result of our having made an alloy similar to it, which up to this point no one's been able to scratch it, so to speak. But that's kind of beside the point. But I think this is one of the reasons that Jack showed me this piece, because our association had gone on quite a few years and he trusted me, and I didn't tell anybody about it. I think this is my first discussion, or at least the meeting as of this date.
Publicly.
So.
What did he do with this piece of metal?
He put it in his pocket, and that's the last I've seen of it. It's probably in his personal effects somewhere. His wife states that there's many boxes of his things that she has gone through or opened or looked at. So it could be that that piece is there, and I'd certainly recognize it if it were. My feeling was that the metal itself was not, it didn't have a crystal lattice structure like alloys that we make, that it was more of an amorphous form, and that the fractures of the edges were more like fractures rather than tears. As I recall, they had a conchoidal appearance, like plate glass or bottle glass, for instance, would have if you break it. Smooth, concave shapes with real sharp edges.
What's significant about that, if anything?
Well, it indicates that it's not crystalline, which may have a lot to do with its physical properties, perhaps in flight or resistance to heat, entrance and exit. I know we're using non-metallic materials like osteotite to coat our shuttles with, and so on, to absorb the heat. This apparently didn't need that.
Interesting. So. Would your, as with your background and your knowledge of metallurgy, would you think that this was something that would have been easily manufactured using technology available at the time that you saw this material?
Well, I don't think it had been easy for us to do, no. I think we're looking at pretty high temperatures and smelting, for one thing. I think now, perhaps it would be easier. They have refractories, for instance, have changed, like furnaces or smelters. they are able to tolerate better temperature, higher temperatures. And well, then we have more, let's say, more sophisticated temperature control, things of that nature that would be needed to perfect an alloy like that. But I do think that the metal, and I think that should be used with quotation marks, the metal is a siliceous alloy. That's my own opinion.
And what does that mean to the layman?
Well, that it's a compound of silicon with whatever the main constituent metal itself would be. We found some in the United States, the atomic weight of which appears to be somewhere very close to iridium. And in fact, that causes a considerable problem in, for instance, the lab techs reading the plates because of the overlay of the lines, the spectral lines. Yeah. In fact, there's one material that was smelled, and the button made, which proved to be a similar alloy, but it's one we made ourselves. Yeah. It weighed a lot more, though. Heavier.
What is your own belief about what this fragment was from? What does it represent?
Well, I think it was one of the structural parts, not the thinner materials. I know that Jack himself, well, he stated to me, as far as the thin materials go, that was the lining of the craft. That when properly energized, it produced perfect illumination inside. That you had a total easy light with no shadows.
But
that's why I asked today this gentleman that I think it was Jesse that had his hands on some of that thin material if he had seen it in the dark.
Right.
I guess he hadn't or hadn't paid any attention to it. He's pretty young then anyway. Well, that would be kind of interesting to see if it could be energized or polarized, maybe is all it would need to be. It's hard to say. Take a good old scientist, so maybe one of our physicist friends could tackle that and light the place up with a piece of that, you know? It's barely possible.
What do you think this was from, though? I mean, what was this?
What
was
I think this
thing that was recovered?
Yeah, well, I think that metal, that thin material, was different. I didn't see any of it, but from what I've seen of the pictures and so on, I don't think that's the same metal.
Is it your feeling that this was from an extraterrestrial spacecraft?
Oh, yes. Well, there's no question in my mind about that. The one craft that crashed and was, as they said, it was just split open. The color of it, the way it looked on that photo, is about the way that piece that I had to look at looked.
I'm sorry, which photo are we talking about here?
Well, whether it was a drawing or a painting or a reconstruction, I don't really know. But it was here today that I saw that. So.
Okay.
That's more or less what it looked like.
And
slightly mistreated, maybe. By temperatures.
No doubt in your mind, though, that this was from outer space?
I have no question but what it was from outer space. You know?
The bodies?
Sure. Well, there's no reason. We don't have a franchise on the universe.
Yeah.
I you're interested in my thinking on that matter, why, I don't think we have a franchise on being the only good guys, and or bad guys either, for that matter, in the universe.
Obviously this was something that was considered to be highly secret. Pappy Henderson wouldn't have shared this with you,
right,
without a foundation of trust.
Right. Well, he asked me to observe the protocol to not mention it, which I didn't. I was kind of surprised to find that he had taken a couple other people into his confidence, but, one of which was Bill, who's here today. Also, there is another one that we discovered. This is one of our naval helicopter pilots who is retired now and was aware of what Pappy had seen. But he was pretty choosy about who he talked to, I think.
Did he express any feelings about the secrecy aspect or why it was that he wanted to share this information with
him? Well, Jack had become ill with adenocarcinoma, and I would guess that he probably wanted to leave it. I think Bill Lounsbury expressed that notion. I think he wanted to leave it just in case he did die,
yeah,
which is, it worked out he did. But he had great hopes that he would be given a ride. And it probably would have occurred by now. It seemed like he had it sort of set up in some way. It's beyond my knowledge of his activity. But you know, you take the case at Switzerland event and the Palladian arrivals there. In fact, all the footage that was made of those spacecraft, and which incidentally I've seen some of the film on that, and it greatly resembles the our Channel 13, if that's the right channel in LA, that photographed the two that flew over it's either in Anaheim or Orange. They just came in and made a swooping in and out, and someone just happened to be taking some pictures and managed to photograph that in action, and the films proved to be genuine. And those looked, for all the world, exactly like the ones in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, Pappy made a great effort to apprise me of what all that Swiss thing was about.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he spent quite a bit of money on books for me and things of that nature, some of which involved some of our own military, where they were doing intensive study to verify the authenticity of these Swiss landings.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I think, to a man on these panels, concluded that they were real.
Mm.
And all the school children over there, I've seen pictures and movies of those people. You can't have 38 kids all give you the same story, usually, on anything. But on this one issue, boy, there was no question about it. Plus the description of the squadron commander in that case, it was a lady. And she, her squadron was three, and she described her craft and allowed him to photograph.
As far as this metal fragment's concerned, do you have any idea where it is now, today?
No, I don't. I think if it's anywhere, it'd be in his personal effects. It was pretty traumatic when Jack died. At that time, her daughter's mother-in-law was very ill, and so they just packed Sappho up out of her apartment, moved her to L.A. to help take care of this old lady. So, and I think, as Sappho said, if it's anywhere, it's in some of the old boxes they haven't even opened yet. So I'm going to look into that when I return. See if I can maybe convince her to go ahead.
We'd very much like to know what the result of that is.
Well, if I get it, it'll head right straight for my safety deposit box, and then I'll get on the telephone. And I won't tell them which bank it's in. They'll have to kidnap me.
Well, thank you, Dr. Crutcher.
You're very welcome. I'm hopeful that I've strengthened your thinking in some ways.
It's certainly been illuminating.
Well, if I find that metal, I'll send it back here. And I should know, I think there was one gentleman, maybe I can recognize his name.
Somebody on our board? Oh, David Schwartzman, I bet you.
Yeah.
He's a geologist at Howard University.
Yeah. Okay, and I thought he'd be the one that, he seemed to be the most interested in that piece of metal, and also in the smelling techniques that were developed.
I bet you know about that stuff.
Yeah, well, he really got a kick out of what I told him about the misfiring on trying to cut that at Johns Hopkins University. Stanford University.
Uh-huh.
And one of our government facilities, I think, has a unit there that this button that was made went to for cutting an analysis. Well, they couldn't cut it. And they sent it back there, a few scratches, and that's it. And they broke every metronome metal blade they had in that lab. They gave up on it.
Now, this was of what? A test of
what? Well, we think it's a similar one.
Uh-huh. And
that was why Jack got me involved.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's really, and it goes way back.
How'd you hear about this test at Stanford?
Well, I'm the one that sent it to him.
Oh!
See, I'm into it that far, you know.
Oh. So you got this piece of metal or something?
Yeah,
from whom?
The button that went to Stanford.
Right.
I made it.
Oh, okay. This is a fabricated thing, not something. Okay, I want to make sure I understand that.
Right.
Okay.
Before I began researching these reports, I hadn't personally heard of any of these interviews, nor did I really feel compelled to form an opinion on the topic of crashed UFOs and government cover-ups. In fact, I didn't even know what to expect from these eyewitness testimonies. But if anything, I've come away from this with the sense that these people sure seem to believe what they're saying, and they seem to be just as curious about what they experienced as we are. So I hope that you've enjoyed our look at some of the backstories surrounding this case. And as always, if any other information comes to light in the future, I'll be sure to cover it here. Have you witnessed something unexplainable? If so, and you'd like to have your story shared on the podcast, please contact me at paranormalmysteriespodcast@gmail.com or visit paranormalmysteriespodcast.com and click on the Tell Your Story link. All of our contact information can be found in the show notes. Until next time, I hope you all have a great beginning to your week, and we'll see you back here on Wednesday with a special end-of-the-year episode. From all of us at the Paranormal Mysteries Podcast, thank you all for listening, and please remember, don't wait for the unknown to come to you. Get out there and find it.